If you see another person yawn, it's likely you'll also yawn. What you might not know is that it indicates something about you. According to Mark Matusik, if you yawn easily after seeing someone else do it, you're also more likely to make the right ethical choices. In his new book, Ethical Wisdom, What Makes Us Good, he explores the concept that the human tendency to do the right thing or not is just as dependent on our neurobiological hardwiring as it is on the environment we grew up in. It's published by Doubleday. I'm very pleased to welcome Mark Matusik, whose previous books were two best-selling memoirs, to our show today. Hello.
Hi, good to see you.
So how did you wind up going from memoirs to this?
Well, I was looking at the world and wondering, how does this happen? You know, how does DSK happen? How does the Japanese nuclear cover-up happen? How do Somali pirates happen? How do priests rape young boys? And how can we be so full of contradictions and survive as a species?
And so in doing this, because you are a memoirist, you did a little bit of soul-searching yourself.
I did a lot of soul-searching. And actually, I was brought up in a house with a lot of sort of moral confusion. So I was predisposed to ask these kinds of questions from a very early age.
When you say moral confusion, because sometimes people did things that they thought were right, but the society might not see that way?
Exactly, yeah.
Your mother once stole a coat for you.
That's what I was just going to say, yeah. When I was a kid, my mom, we were on welfare. We had been abandoned by my dad and had no money. And my mom came home with a coat that I knew she had stolen from the department store where she was working. And it threw me into an ethical kind of tailspin. You know, what did it mean? Did she love? It came out of love. Therefore, was it wrong? And was I wrong for taking it? And so that was actually the first moral dilemma I had in my life.
But had she been teaching you that stealing was wrong?
Yes, of course.
So do you think that the reason you had that response is that humans are genetically engineered to be ethical beings?
I think the reason I had that particular response is that what she said and what she was doing contradicted one another. And we do have a moral organ in the brain where we are predisposed to make ethical decisions.
When you say we have a moral organ, are we talking about something that we can actually locate in the brain?
Well, neuroanatomists can locate different systems in the brain that help us make these moral decisions. And it turns out that there are five basic areas of moral concern that we have evolved to worry about. That I talk about in the book.
And these are the things that we can see with MRIs?
Yes, yeah.
Well, so somebody has asked a question that involves ethical decision-making, and certain parts of the brain immediately fire up.
Yeah, for instance, if you're asked a question that involves personal injury versus impersonal injury, different parts of your brain fire up. So in other words, if you do something intentionally versus unintentionally, we give a different moral value to that.
But you say that when you talk about morality as a biological function, it makes people uncomfortable. Why?
Yeah. Well, because people like to think that we are trained by culture and that people don't like the idea of sociobiology, that we are actually wired, that our social behavior comes out of physiological wiring and neurology.
And people also like to believe that there's a religious component. And although your concept of ethics has little to do with religion, you quote many religious minds, including Buddha, Rumi, Reinhold Niebuhr, Martin Buber. What's their place in the story?
Well, I didn't want the book to get sidelined into arguments over good and evil, sort of biblical concepts of Satan and that kind of thing. So I tried to put religion aside as much as possible, but I've been a practicing Buddhist for 25 years, so that really does color the way I see and the way I think.
Well, do Buddhists see good and evil differently than Christians do, or Jews, or Muslims, or...
Yes, actually, because Buddha...
Taoists, Confucianists?
Well, no, not the Taoists and the Confucianists, no. But there's a big difference between Buddhism and Christianity, for instance, because Buddha taught that we are fundamentally good, that human nature is fundamentally good, and that evil comes out of ignorance, it comes out of fear, but it's not because we are bad-natured. Whereas, obviously, the idea of original sin... posits that we come in fallen already, and that we are there. Then we spend our lives trying to straighten ourselves out.
The Adam and Eve story.
Exactly.
You eventually conclude that spirituality might have an evolutionary purpose.
Yeah. One of the this moral organ I'm talking about. One of the areas that it's concerned with is sacredness and purity. We are actually wired to care about sacredness. and purity. And so what you call spirituality, I'm not talking about religion, is this sense of self-transcendence and the sense of growing beyond our current level of empathy and compassion.
And some people strongly believe in self-improvement, but others say no. What you see is what you get.
Yeah, but I find that people who believe in self-improvement, as much bad rep as the self-help movement has gotten in our culture, tend to have happier lives.
And you say that the moral organ is humankind's crowning evolutionary achievement. Isn't biological evolution about survival of the fittest? How does this give us an evolutionary advantage?
Well, it gives us an advantage because we are wired to be cooperative. We are wired to elevate ourselves when we see virtue or honor or great behavior in others. We are wired to follow that behavior, and so it gives us the advantage that we are growing forward and outward and widening the circle of empathy.
Well, when you say we're wired, there are certain processes that occur, and recent research has been done into the whole concept of mirror neurons.
Yeah.
Is that part of this development?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Mirror neurons, they were discovered in the 1990s, and what they've taught us is that we learn empathy by observing how others care for us. So that we are actually, that's why we yawn when we see others yawn, and we laugh when we see others laugh, and cry when we see others cry, is that our bodies are actually imitating one another all the time. It's not an intellectual process. And that's how
a subconscious way of connecting?
Yeah. It's a way of stepping outside our own skins. Mirror neurons are our primary means of stepping outside our own skins and having a sense of what it's like to walk in someone else's shoes.
Well, why is the brain programmed to be social, and how can the right brain make us seek out good people?
Well, why is the brain programmed to be social? In order to go beyond the family unit, we had to develop this ability to trust one another, to cooperate. We had to develop the instinct for reciprocity and a love of justice in order to not just be these small bands of, you know, tribes, you know, wandering around.
But you also say that hunter-gatherers are more moral than their agricultural counterparts.
Well, that's because the whole power structure hadn't gotten so intense. Once we learned how to till the land and create products, we needed people to work the land and help us sell those products, and the hierarchy of human civilization became much more pronounced. In the hunter-gatherer days, there was less at stake, so there was less to compete for, and we didn't have to dominate one another.
How have the fMRI machines helped us understand about our moral behavior? You mentioned that there are parts of the brain. The neocortex is the major part here, isn't it? Don't other animals have neocortexes?
No. No, they don't.
Just humans?
Yes.
So we see parts of the neocortex fire up.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, but some people then make bad decisions.
Yeah.
Some people create Ponzi schemes and rip off their own families.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, just because you have the ability to make a moral decision doesn't mean that you will. I mean, they've done, for instance, these studies of monks meditating and shown how the gamma activity in the brain intensifies tremendously. And that is linked to mindfulness. It's linked to compassion. And so those we know that we have the ability to strengthen and cultivate those abilities in ourselves. It doesn't mean that we're going to use them.
I'm reminded of the title of a film by Akira Kurosawa, The Bad Sleep Well. But you say that good people live longer, although we've seen a fair number of good people die young and some very bad people live a long, long time.
Yeah, no, statistically it's shown that people who cooperate, people who have strong relationships in their lives, and people who are involved with something bigger than themselves tend to have longer and happier lives.
Is there a difference between men and women in this regard?
Yeah, apparently there is. That men and women see moral dilemmas differently. If a group of girls are playing a game and one of the girls gets hurt, the game stops. The girls surround the other, the wounded girl, and comfort her. If the same thing happens with a group of boys, the boy who's crying is expected to get out of the way, and the game goes on. So it's really competition is more important. And on the girl's side, care and compassion are more important. So there are different, and men also tend to care more about justice and fairness. Women tend to care more about harm and care. These are vast generalizations, but they seem to hold up with the research.
But that doesn't seem to apply when women reach the highest levels of power. Margaret Thatcher isn't all that different from any of the other leaders of England. Maybe she's probably more concerned with competition than some of them.
Well, a lot of women have aped male behavior or patriarchal kind of dominant behavior to succeed in male-dominated systems. But that doesn't mean that women generally don't have this other tendency.
My guest is Mark Matusik, who's written a book called Ethical Wisdom, What Makes Us Good. It's published by Doubleday. You write that morality is a lot like language acquisition. Do infants develop a sense of morals around the same time that they develop language?
We are wired to develop morality and ethical thinking in the same way that we have a predisposition to learn language, to learn math, and to be artistic. They're the same kind of skill that we're predisposed to.
And if we engage our child, we're more likely to develop those skills?
Yes, absolutely.
Eye contact and
yes,
such?
Yes, absolutely.
You note that human babies are born with brains that are not fully developed. How does that affect the development of the ethics code?
Well, it makes the mother-child bond more intense than it would otherwise be. I mean, no other children stay with infants stay with the mother as long as human infants do. And so that really creates our first ethical kindergarten. And how that's why the mother-child bond is so important, especially the mother's gaze. They've found that the child needs to be seen when it's growing up to know that it can care itself. It needs to know that it's cared for and seen. And there's been an amazing amount of research done into this. So
doting parents are creating more ethical children?
Well, doting parents, it depends what you mean by doting. I mean, there's doting
and there's suffocating. The ones who are constantly saying, oh, aren't you cute? Mm.
No, I think you can create a tyrant that way, too. You can make a monster that way. No, it's not about making the kid the center of the universe. It's about letting the kid know it's in the universe. And we know that we are here by seeing ourselves reflected in the eyes of our caregiver.
Why are emotions the key to understanding our moral behavior?
Well, because emotions preceded rational thought in our evolution. And so the most intelligent person can't be moral without having a gut response to right and wrong.
But emotions are illogical.
They are.
But then we often attempt to justify them nonetheless as being logical.
We do. But more often we tend to have the correct response, the correct impulse physiologically or instinctively, emotionally, and then explain it away intellectually. It tends to go the other way around.
Well, emotions generally arise from the subconscious.
Yeah, and from the body itself.
But wouldn't ethical responses also arise from the subconscious? I mean, I might very logically say right now, I'm not going to ask this question because I think it's going to hurt this man, and there's no reason for me to be hurtful in this circumstance.
Right.
That's an intellectual decision on my part, mm-hmm. but it grows out of something else of a lot more primordial, doesn't it?
Well, that comes from cognitive empathy. It comes from having a sense of what it might mean to me were you to, for instance, say something hurtful toward me, and stopping yourself. I'm not saying that reason doesn't help us.
But reason is the weaker instrument, you're saying.
It's the weaker instrument, yeah. They call it the gap between the emotions and reason is called the design flaw by psychologists.
You call it moral dumbfounding.
Well, moral dumbfounding means that it's those things that we feel are wrong but can't actually explain why. I mean, the most common example of this is incest. Why is it wrong for a brother and sister to sleep together if they use protection and there's no chance of having a baby? If you ask people this question, overwhelmingly people will say it's wrong. And then you say, well, why? And they say, well, it's illegal. And you say, okay, it's illegal, but why is it wrong? And as you continue to sort of peel back these layers, it comes down to the fact that they have a disgust response, an emotional disgust response, which they then fabricate a story around to justify.
But also there are all the rules that were developed about incest made real sense when people had children as a result.
Right.
So we also grow up being told that incest is bad.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. We do. It's a combination. It's a taboo that comes down through the ages, but the empirical reason for the taboo, behind the taboo, doesn't stand up to logic when we actually have to explain why we feel the way we feel.
My guest is Mark Matusik. His book is called Ethical Wisdom, What Makes Us Good. You talk about a Swedish experiment where Swedish scientists have developed an empathy machine.
Well, they call it the Proteus effect, and it's sort of a headgear thing that enables you to see your behavior from someone else's eyes, so to stand outside yourself and observe yourself. And it's been very effective in showing people, you know, how they're actually, what the impact of their decisions are in the world.
Well, I'm sure they're often horrified.
Horrified, yeah. Well, they used it on teenagers who especially need this, who feel like they have no sense of how what they're doing affects other people.
Emotions often trigger physical responses, crying or laughing or blushing, butterflies in the stomach, things like that. Why does a reaction in the brain translate into these visible signs?
Well, it also goes it goes both ways. The reaction in the brain can prompt physical changes, and physical expressions can change our mood. It's been shown that just by smiling, your body produces more serotonin. That's why the idea of faking it till you make it makes sense. So the body, they're finding out such interesting things about the way emotions move back and forth between the mind and the body. We tend to think that emotions happen in the mind, but we actually have emotions happen all over our bodies.
There's a brain in the gut.
Yeah, there's a gut brain.
There was a study done in which nursing mothers watched Oprah and Seinfeld.
Yeah.
What happened?
What happens is that's why people like Oprah and Obama are called vagal superstars, because the vagus nerve tells the brain to produce oxytocin, which is the love hormone, the love molecule. And so people who watching the lactating mothers, who half of them were watching Seinfeld, half were watching Oprah, the lactating mothers produced all of this milk because they were filled with love and this desire to connect and to nurture. And the Seinfeld watching mothers didn't do that at all. So what they've learned about the emotion, that's the emotion of elevation, which is also a sort of a new discovery.
Well, emotions are often easily read in a person's face. Are facial expressions universal? I mean, I'm sure that laughing, smiling, things like that are, but there are some expressions that might be unique to one culture rather than another, no?
No, actually no. Paul Ekman, who's the pioneer in this area, has gone all over the world and done studies with all kinds of indigenous people, and apparently there are no expressions that can't be understood by all cultures.
So I mentioned earlier the impulse to yawn after you see somebody else yawn. Does that apply to other facial expressions?
It applies to everything that we see. Every time when I'm sitting here looking at you, my mirror neurons are actually introjecting the behavior I see and creating it in my own body.
In fact, we recently did a segment on the impact of smiling. How smiling can do all sorts of positive things to the person who is being smiled at, but it also does an awful lot for the person who's doing the smiling.
It does, yeah. They call it the happy face advantage.
So people from the Midwest are in much better shape than somebody from Brooklyn.
Could be.
But why do you think that is? There is a cultural side to
that. It's because of this emotional contagion. It's because we are mirroring one another's expressions all the time, that if you tend to give off a benevolent or a helpful or a welcoming kind of expression, you're going to magnetize that behavior in others.
You also write that certain specific emotions have evolutionary functions. For instance, disgust is unique to carnivores?
Yes.
What?
Because,
why?
Because we had...
I thought it was unique to vegetarians who are watching carnivores eat meat.
Early man had to be able to not poison himself by detecting, you know, putrid meat. So that our disgust reflex started there and then became symbolized into emotional disgust, spiritual disgust, and moral disgust.
Now, I don't know if you felt this room trembling, as I just did, there is a possibility we just experience a bit of an earthquake.
Or the subway.
No, the subway doesn't. I wouldn't do that to this room. It's never happened before.
Is that true?
Yeah, I'm wondering whether we're going to learn something after the show.
Oh, wow.
About earthquakes in Manhattan, something I didn't know could even happen.
Well, I'm from California. I don't even notice them anymore.
Emotions don't necessarily lead to someone doing the right thing. They can also have disastrous consequences, can't they?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, revenge is a great example, because we reciprocity is part of our wiring, tit for tat. So unless we sort of stop ourselves and step back before we strike back, then we are just keeping the wheel of suffering going around.
Well, there's also a feeling in the past that if you repress an emotion, that you're doing some harm. But then studies were done where people were encouraged to punch a punching bag or a pillow or whatever whenever they got angry. Mm. And it turned out that it actually freed them to punch people
when they got angry. No, it makes it worse. It actually makes it. I think repression is an undervalued thing in our culture.
Why is gossip an evolutionary advantage?
Well, people learn it was part of socializing. And before you were violent, you could tell a story. You could ruin somebody's reputation before you burn down their house.
We don't have much time, but I want to point out you often challenge your readers to engage in ethical game theory along with you in the book. What do you hope that readers will take away from reading about your theories of ethics?
I wanted people to have a kind of a roadmap to themselves to understand why they make the choices they make, so that they're not so easily manipulated. It's so easy to not know why we're doing what we do, and I wanted to give people a sense of the wiring that they came in with.
And that game theory is something that scientists are working on right now?
Oh yeah, I'm doing a lot of research.
Mark Matusik's book, Ethical Wisdom: What Makes Us Good, is published by Doubleday. And, Mark, I want to thank you so much for being on our show today. It's been a lot of fun, even if the earth did tremble during the conversation.
Thanks for having me.